This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. And of course, we have our doctor in the house in with me, Lee Chui Lin, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Hello.
Good afternoon.
It's nice to have you back.
Oh, thank you very much. And it's a Friday. And today is very exceptional because we don't have a guest today.
We don't. But we have a very interesting topic
Indeed.
In lieu of having a guest.
Exactly.
And in case, you know, somehow you missed the fuss or you just kind of didn't catch it, here's a preview of what we're going to be discussing today.
Thank you for waiting for me. I gave everybody a scare. The last time I did this, I was on the parade square in Southie and fainted. I think that's what happened. I've never had so many doctors look at me all at once. They think I'm all right, but anyway, I'm going to have a full checkup after this.
So, over the weekend, Singapore PM Lee Hsien Loong fainted as he was delivering a speech during a National Day rally. And what you just heard was him returning to the stage after about 20 minutes to finish his speech. And after saying he's never had so many doctors
That's
look
right.
at him.
Yes.
So what do we know about what led to
what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you read all the news reports, an interesting thing is that if you go onto YouTube and then you see how this was a live broadcast of his speech on National Day. And then somehow when this was happening, then the camera was veering to somewhere else. And then suddenly there was kind of like interruptions on screen. And then, you know, clearly, you know, it was being managed, you know, but thank goodness, you know, Mr. Lee recovered very well. And then 1 hour and 20 minutes later, obviously, you know, standing ovation from everybody and everyone's, you know, obviously had a bit of a scare. And the official line is that he has a vasovagal attack, you know, like in normal terms, it is a fainting attack. Apparently, this was, you know, a 2 hour long speech afterwards, right? Any one of us under the glaring spotlights and all,
the heat.
And has been standing, you know, probably throughout the whole day of celebrations, will actually encounter that sort of like fainting attack. I mean, in the medical viewpoint, it is a very simple thing. It is a trigger of dehydration. It's a trigger of tiredness, prolonged standing. And in our brain, we have one part that actually will have all these triggers and will cause these vasovagal attack because our body's heart contractilities, our blood pressure, and then also everything else is controlled by a parasympathetic system and the sympathetic system. The parasympathetic system, when it's activated, the heart will contract less. And then the blood pressure, if it's deactivated, the sympathetic system is deactivated, then the blood pressure will drop. This happens usually when somebody, you know, in my practice, when you see somebody, when you're taking blood, and then, you know, the family member standing at a corner, suddenly bang on the floor, and then you know that someone has a vasovagal attack. You know, that triggered the blood.
So this can happen to anybody?
Anybody.
Even if you're perfectly healthy?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And then so basically a fainting attack. I mean, you know, obviously, in fact, it actually happens in many, many younger people. It's like young adults and then, you know, and you know, for somebody who has the absolute phobia of the sight of blood, well, this will happen. And of course, you know, it can be triggered by a doctor giving you medication. If you have a high blood pressure medication, and then, you know, from sitting and standing, that sort of things, you suddenly have dizzy spell. If you don't kind of lie down immediately, then that is called orthostatic, blood pressure change. And then sometimes you also have the syncope. Syncope means fainting, you know, like mid-duration syncope. When you pee and after peeing, you actually faint. This is a well-recognized.
Very sad.
It is very sad. It is very sad. But obviously, it is not pathological. Like for someone like Lee Hsien Loong, you had a trigger, and then, you know, obviously all the doctors were rushing to him and then making sure that he's all right. But we have to remember, this guy is 64 years old.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And that's why I asked whether, you know, even perfectly healthy people can have a fainting attack. Because there have been concerns over Lee Hsien Loong's health in the past. Mm. You know, this is not the first health scare that, you know, that he's been involved in. He's after all, a cancer survivor, right?
Twice over. That's right. You know, in 1992, he had lymphoma. You know, he had to take 1 year out and then, you know, and underwent chemotherapy. In 1993, he was declared healthy again. And obviously, that was a first cancer survivor. And last year, he famously had a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And the prostate cancer was diagnosed just before Chinese New Year. And during Chinese New Year, which is, you know, a lot of Chinese will be very pantang to have an operation. And he did a lot of good for that, sort of like a taboo. And then he had an operation on the second day. He had it on the 16th of February, and he went back to work something like on the 18th and fully back to work on the a week later.
And for you, I mean, you're not his doctor, unless you're not telling us something.
Right,
but, you know, from what we know, you're not his doctor. So for you, looking at that time scale, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, we have this drive. In medicine, we have this drive, and everything has to be daycare. I mean, if you think about childbirth in the old days, you know, you need to rest afterwards, right? Okay, you know, in the hospital, you have 2-3 days at least. Some people stay for a whole week. And in these days, you want it out of the hospital straight away, right? Okay, and if you look at any research like keyhole surgery, they actually count the moment of the patient getting into hospital and then the moment of the patient getting out of the hospital to the minute, to actually say the operation time is such how many minutes, X minutes, the hospitalized time is Y minute. And, you know, because we have such pressure to have this fight against time to get patient back to work straight away. And of course, you know, widely publicized operation that he had is a robotic operation. I mean, it really sounds as sci-fi as it is that, you know, we have as many arms as possible trying to extract this cancerous growth out of him. And all these are keyhole operation, is state of the art. And then what medicine trying to prove is that we can defy what the old school teaching is rest afterwards and then recuperate.
But is that a bad thing? I mean, I wonder whether for somebody who, I assume, you know, as a prime minister of a country, feels a lot of pressure to, you know, get back up and going, you combine that with doctors going, okay, 36 hours, you're out of here.
I know. So, you know, sometimes in a lot of American studies, you know, when we scrutinize the journals, they have all these publications to say, you know, after radical robotic surgery, patient out of the hospital within 18.5 hours, that sort of thing, right? Okay. And the reality is that they're out of hospital, but they actually shifted to a hotel next door so that they are still somehow having care. So it is, on one hand, a good thing. It's pushing forward frontiers for certain reasons as well, because the old thinking of bed rest and things like that sometimes might provoke certain complications, such as deep vein thrombosis. However, when you actually push the patient a bit too far, after a certain age, you know, you might actually make this counterproductive. I mean, what will be an interesting conversation for the Klang Valley to join today is that, do you think sometimes, you know, actually making fast recovery and actually pushing you back to work straight away, something like this, actually is a good thing? Like, for example, Lee Hsien Loong. And then do you think that the politician has a different rule books, you know, because they are expected never really get old, they're expected to be strong. You know, somebody laughed and said he has to get a sick leave because the guy actually is on like a medical leave until Monday. And then people kind of say, well, is that necessary? It's like, you know, that isn't that strange? You know, it's interesting now to open up the conversation to say that, do you think politicians have a different rule books because they have to be appeared to be really robust and cannot even defy the nature's illness or aging?
Give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Are politicians under too much pressure when it comes to their health and when it comes to aging? Because that's something we're seeing a lot more of as well. Older world leaders. You know, we, of course, Hillary Clinton's health has famously come under scrutiny because she is going to be a rather old president, should she be nominated.
How old is Clinton?
I want to say that she'll be 70.
Right, okay.
I want to say that. I could be wrong, right. But certainly in that range, it's not far off. Even if it isn't, you know, even if it isn't a number starting with seven, it's not far off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the kind of American system, everything is very publicized. I mean, people argue that Hillary Clinton is criticized for anything, right? You know, it's criticized for being a woman. She's criticized for, you know, the emails and everything like that. And actually looking at the health, is that a fair criticism? And then when you choose a politician, will the youth and the vigor actually is something that is important? That
is it to you? I mean, when you look at... So, for example, we always have the stereotype of you prefer an older doctor.
Right.
You know, even, right?
I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, there is that. I mean, I've heard that so many times. You see a young doctor walk in and you think, what, you just graduated? You know, you're going to...
And Doogie Howser.
Right. Yeah, but with politicians, I don't know whether the same is true. Like, are you comfortable with having an older person leading your country for, you know, 4 years, 8 years?
Yeah.
You know, are you okay with that?
Well, I mean, recently we had, you know, the... Canadian Prime Minister, who's someone's young, even the Italian Prime Minister, I think, is someone who's quite young. I think that create a lot of buzz, you know, that sort of like young people taking this in a different angle. However, you also want that stability of the older politicians, right? Okay, I mean, I really adore someone like Margaret Thatcher, you know, because I know it's my era. It's kind of like, you know, she is somebody who's, even though aging and then was sleeping, like famously sleeping 4 hours, was, you know, can actually have any form of kind of like things thrown at her. That's why she's the Iron Lady, right? Okay. But, you know, do we in 2016 still expect our politicians to behave with that sort of Margaret Thatcher's kind of like a
drive,
you know, and, you know, on one hand you have the experience, but yet you still have that youth that can go with that.
Well, that's Dr. George's question. My question, on the other hand, is do people get VIP treatment? Because we're going to be talking about that after this. What happens when doctors are faced with important patients, whether that changes how you behave. Dr. George, I'm talking to you. We're opening up the phone lines as always. So if you'd like to join us just to offer a question or a story or a thought, that number 0377109000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. It's our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consulting urologist in the studio with me, Lee Chui Lin. And today we're talking about, well, we're talking about a number of different things. We started off by examining what happened with the Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Hsien Loong, who fainted when he was delivering a speech during Singapore's National Day rally. He turned out to be okay.
Yeah, after attended by so many doctors.
Exactly, right? Which led us to wonder whether VIPs get special treatment. So we're asking you two questions today. One is, do you think VIPs get special treatment by doctors? And two is, do you think that politicians are under additional stress, additional pressure to not let health get in the way of them doing their job? Give us a call. That number is 0377109000. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So we've got a couple of questions that have come in via text. Mm-hmm. One is very medical. Dr. George, what's the difference between a vasovagal attack and vertigo?
Okay, vasovagal response or vasovagal attack, sometimes called syncope. And essentially, it's just highlighting a group of triggers that actually may result in that low blood pressure. I mean, that can be prolonged standing, you know, like I said, you know, standing up very quickly, stress, dehydration, heat, and then that sort of thing. But, you know, vertigo is completely just one condition that actually is it's resulting in dizziness and then fainting. And then so vasovagal attack is reversible. It's only one off. And then vertigo obviously needs treatment in order to resolve that in long term.
And vertigo here, we're talking about the imbalance that happens.
Correct, yeah. And then it's the specific reasons that it's because of the you know, apparatus in the ear that actually results in imbalance and then causing dizziness, nausea feeling, and that's vertigo. Yeah.
Another question that I'm just going to say up front, I don't think we can answer, but I'm going to put it out as an opinion. Is there a correlation between a corrupt politician and good health because they don't have as much stress compared to a leader who is not corrupt?
Right, okay.
I don't know that is...
Well, that's not true. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't know. Whenever it depends on whether you have guilty conscience, really. It's like, you know, if somebody who actually have guilty conscience, you might don't sleep very well, and then might actually affect your health. And it depends on individual, really, I think.
I'm assuming it's a pretty stressful life, actually, being a corrupt politician. I'm not excusing it, but I'm just saying.
I think being a politician itself, it's a stressful life already.
Agreed. Yeah. And that leads me quite neatly to ask, Dr. George, without getting you in trouble, so do you treat VIPs?
Right, okay. Yes, I do treat VIPs. I mean, sometimes VIPs are referred to me unknowingly. The most embarrassing about treating VIP is you actually don't know who that person is until someone tells you. Because, sometimes you ask the usual questions. How old are you? Are you married? You got kids? Any past medical history? And what work do you do? And then somebody will just say, I'm an actor. And it's like, oh, really? What do you, what film do you
have? Have I seen you in something?
That's right. Or I'm a politician. It's like, and you suddenly just pause and then think, should I know you? And then that is the most difficult thing, in my opinion. But
when you do know them.
Oh, I'm not sure that they get special treatment, but I think sometimes they demand special treatment.
And are you able to view them as, patients, purely patients, without thinking, oh no, I'm actually, doing something that might affect somebody that I know or somebody who's going to make the papers tomorrow?
Well, Sod's law tell you that when you operate or do something on somebody who's famous, something is bound to go wrong. And that is my biggest fear. It's like, and we all heard that horrible story of, the son-in-law of a very prominent politician, passed away because of medical complications. And I guess medical complications can happen to anyone, but at the back of our mind, when we treat anyone who is of that sort of caliber, and then the worst thing that can happen to you is that, you end up having problems. And then I think, I must admit, that that is something that crossed my mind rather than, if I give you this medication, you decide not to take it, what do you do? It's like, and are we equal? Can we maintain that doctor-patient relationship? I don't know. And also, I think occasionally I'm being put under pressure by myself. I mean, majority of them are pretty nice and said, doctor, whatever you say, I'll do, right? Okay. And you kind of like come up with all these kind of like pressure for yourself and say, well, yes, of course, YB, you've got these options, you've got that options. And they say, doctor, just tell me. And yeah, sometimes it's a bit awkward.
We're curious to hear from you. What's your take on the VIP status?
Do you think VIP gets special treatment?
Until you told me no, I thought, yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that they come in and they get rushed through and they get to skip the lines and they get to demand things. That's what I would assume.
Yeah, that's what I say. Just like the road that it's cleared for VIP to go past with all the sirens.
And we've all experienced that. That's always been kind of what I thought. And I'm curious to know whether you guys share that opinion. Did you assume that VIP treatment existed? And what's your take on it? And also,
I'm curious to hear from the public, have they experienced that certain VIP just cut through the queues in the medical line and then, and because you just assume when you're ill, everyone is equal. And then, and how did that make you feel?
And are you a VIP? If you're a VIP, let us know if you've received special treatment.
Now it's getting interesting.
That number to call, 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've talked about this before, about whether or not the doctor is still the boss. Would you say in any given clinical setting, the doctors should still be the boss? I mean, even if you're dealing with somebody who is President Obama, for instance, if President Obama walks into your clinic, are you the boss?
I would like to dispute that a little bit, right? I think in the last 20 years or so in medical school, we try to change that mindset, to say that, doctors know best, and then this is the way that I tell you to do it, just follow it. And in the last two decades or so, obviously, the internet era has changed many things. Many people will come in with a printout, and you can't be dismissive and say, ah, it's all rubbish, go away. And it's like, And the other thing is that it's a freedom. It's a free economy. It's like, if I come to see you, I feel that your attitude is bad, and then you also are not up to date with medical information, I can choose to go and see someone else. And those two things in combination of that makes doctors upset that it has to be empowerment of the patient. And so when somebody comes into my clinic and then I actually put the ball in my court and say, look, I would like you to make decision for me. And I just take that as you hand me that decision, the empowerment. But however, whenever I make decisions, I really would like to make the decision together. You know, I want to make sure that patient understands the consequences, the benefits of operation. And I really think that is crucially important because, after all, that is an informed consent.
And it is them who are going to be living with it after whatever the decision is.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, Obama comes in, you know, it's just like Joe Blog, who is a char kway teow man, who comes in. I would do the same thing unless Joe Blog said to me that, I'm sorry, but I don't understand what you're saying. I mean, I'm clearly doing a bad job if he doesn't understand what I'm telling him about the operation. And then, or just said, doctor, I don't want to be making that decision. I want you to make that decision on my behalf.
Because you know best.
Because you know best.
Right.
And that is also a very dangerous thing for doctors to know best, because what you assume is something that they may or may not be happy with may not be necessarily be the right thing.
I'm all for patient empowerment. I don't want to sound like I'm not. I'm just curious whether it ever happens that it goes too far and somebody is, you know, overly combative on issues where, you know, the science, for example, is not on their side.
Correct, yeah. I mean, typical thing I would imagine will be Steve Jobs, pancreatic cancer, herbal
insisting on vegetables.
That's right,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, that will be a situation where you know, empowerment's gone too far.
Yeah.
Right? You know, even for somebody of a genius caliber like Steve Jobs would go down that route, you know?
And how do you deal with that? So, okay, we've gone from you being Barack Obama's doctor to Steve Jobs' doctor. What would you do?
I don't think you have any choice because...
Can you fire your patient?
Fire
as such.
Right. Well, I mean, you can discontinue care. I mean, most of the time it's a patient who fires you rather than you fire the patient. Is that because if you keep banging on about the operation and then clearly Steve Jobs didn't want the operation and he'll just walk out. He would just say, you don't understand. This is what I want. And, you know, the first rule of medicine actually is do no harm, right? Okay. However, if the patient wants to do harm to themselves, and then this is the right of an autonomy, you know, and, you know, this is patient's autonomy, which is the second rule that we also have to respect. So do no harm and respect autonomy. And that, I think, is empowerment.
Izati via Twitter says, politicians seem to age overnight while in power. Does their health stay the same? I doubt it.
Well, you know what? The best person to reflect that politician age very fast, you know, when they're in power is Tony Blair, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's like, you know, just before, you know, he was in power, you know, Tony
young
Blair.
And handsome.
Young and
yeah.
Handsome, you know, darling of Labour Party. And then, you know, as soon as Gordon Brown took over, you know, he had grey hair, he was knackered. And I really think that, you know, politicians probably have to have the health status of certain caliber to withstand the rigor of a stringent political life, I think.
What are the effects of stress that you've seen in your practice? Because I'm guessing the people who come to you, I'm sure some of them have stressful jobs, maybe not as stressful as people who have, you know, nuclear codes, but, you know, still stressful nonetheless. And what are the effects of stress that you see on their health?
Well, the most... kind of telling the most prominent or important things that affect me or relationship between myself and my patient is the compliance. They are so busy that they may not want to take the medicine for a long time. That's one problem that I find very difficult. The second problem about compliance is that they decide that they don't come back and they come back when they want to. And that is another compliance issue that actually makes treatment extremely difficult.
Because, I mean, if I'm coming back just when I want to, that means it's too late, right?
It is, right. So let's say somebody, you know, Barack Obama comes to see me with enlarged prostate. And then I said to him that, okay, this is some sort of infection. You need to get yourself treated and need to come back to check that it's gone. Right. Okay. And then you take some pills and then it worked. And then you kind of say, oh, it's worked now. I'm so busy. I'm sorry. I'm not going back. And that is a definite stress because compliance is an issue. And so when you come back, it is technically it's too late. So I find that very, very stressful. And the other thing that, you know, coming back to Lee Hsien Loong, and whenever they're in public arena, and to one of the politicians who came to me and then with a PSA detection, and one of the fear that he had was how that PSA can change his career. You know, the PSA, it's elevated, and he has this fear that if I make that diagnosis that this turned out to be cancer, and his career may be over because suddenly cancer will change everything, right? And because of that, he refused to accept that a high PSA might equal to cancer. And then he just kind of like said, doctor, this is my biggest fear. And I find that really scary because, you know, rather than thinking that if I have cancer, I want it treated because my health is more important. But for him, his political career is more paramount compared to his health. And that is a definite no-no when it comes to health.
Let us know, are you of the opinion that politicians are just under too much pressure when it comes to their health? You know, as evidenced by Lee Hsien Loong waking up, being surrounded by a whole team of doctors, you know, because he just needs to get back on his feet, as he has twice after cancer even. Give us a call. That number is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, via text, what is your advice, Dr. George, on diet for busy VIPs who need to attend so many meetings and functions that would serve oily, unhealthy meals?
Right, okay. I mean, not just a VIP, it's just for all of us, right? You know, urban lifestyle, you know, we don't really eat regularly, we don't have balanced diet, and we have exposure to oily meals, and sometimes you have to entertain people to eat the food that you don't like, right? Okay. And I really think that I actually learned it from a very nice, good friend of mine who is a Frenchman, who actually say that entertainment sometimes actually is you abusing your own body. So what you do is pretend you're drinking, pretend you're eating the food, but at the end of the day, just it is a show. It is all entertainment. So at the end of the day, have a balanced diet yourself, had fixed time to take them, and then that is the way to regularize your own diet and your health.
So you're not a believer then in VIP treatment?
Not for those sort of things. Not for something that may mean other people suffering. Let's say, for example, waiting time. If I get directive to say that this person has got extremely, extremely busy lifestyle, it has only got 2 minutes to spare. And then so, you know, if other people just wait another 5 minutes or 10 minutes or so, I think for something like that, it's manageable. But when it comes to something important, like someone else's life or someone else's health might be compromised, I think as any doctor shouldn't compromise that.
We're discussing VIP treatment.
No matter
today.
how high your VIP status is, I think as a doctor, you know, first do no harm.
We're discussing VIP treatment today and whether or not that affects medical care. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know. Have you noticed VIP treatment? What's your take on the idea that VIPs might get special treatment in the medical setting? That number to call 03-77-109-000. You can also reach us by texting 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back after the market update. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. And as always, our guest on a Friday, Dr. George Lee, consulting urologist and our doctor in the house. We're talking today about the medical treatment that VIPs get. And we're talking about this because, of course, Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong had a bit of a fainting spell, scared everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we're wondering, what is it like to treat people who lead countries?
Well, I mean, I just like to be the fly on the wall that day. You know, obviously, you know, he didn't fall. And then, you know, he was assisted to sit down. And usually that is a treatment for vasovagal, because when somebody faints and then their body becomes horizontal, the blood will go to the brain and then they will gain consciousness again. And then you could see from the video clip that, you know, he was about to lose consciousness. And whenever you lie flatter, and then that will be the case. And then we recover consciousness. You imagine, you know, in a Singapore kind of like in a arena like that, you will have hundreds of doctors, you know. And then, you know, Prashant once said that, you know, you just need to spit, and then in Singapore then you'll get a gynecologist or someone like that. So you have everybody swamping there, you know, to either offer their help or to offer their opinion. But actually, that might not be a good thing, because I can tell you what happened to myself. You know, I recently went to a 25-year anniversary in Cambridge, and then there were 88 of us out of 120, we went back and then to kind of have a reunion. And we invited our anatomy teacher, who was about 85 years old. And obviously, everyone had a good fun and then, had a bit of sherry and that sort of thing. And Mrs. Elliot, who was about 85 years old, suddenly just had a bit too much and fell over. And when she was on the floor, and everybody just went there and said, there were 88 doctors there, right? Okay. And everyone looked at her and said, well, not sure it's cardiology. I'm not sure it's, orthopedics. Not sure it's, urology. And as everybody just looked at her until, the husband said, for goodness sake, would somebody just get the ambulance, please? So sometimes when you get so many doctors attending to somebody, a patient, and then, you might get that kind of like, I'm not too sure whether I will be able to help that sort of scenario.
Shouldn't doctors just help?
Yeah, well, this was quite interesting to see that, 88 Cambridge graduates, standing there and everyone's the doctor. And then, just looking at this professor of anatomy's wife lying there, clearly had a fractured neck or femur, and then just wondering what to do. It's an interesting scenario.
You call it interesting. I call it scary.
Scary.
You would think that, a room of over 80 doctors is the safest room.
It's the safest room. I know that the safest thing at that time was the ambulance to take her to the hospital,
where more doctors could look at her.
That's right. Okay. Eventually, everyone was fighting to actually, she made good recovery. Thank goodness for that.
I don't know about the story. On that note, though, Raymond asks, are doctors healthier than the general population?
Okay, I want to ask you that, Lynn. What do you think?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think doctors are the general population with medical brains.
Right. I agree with you. And in fact, I remember the days in the 70s and 80s when I went to see doctors, and then, my GP had a cigarette in his hand and actually said to us, like, look, cigarettes, smoking is bad for you. Don't do what we do. And of course, we don't kind of like do that anymore. And however, you get many doctors who are overweight, many doctors don't exercise, and then so evidently, one sitting here. And I think increasingly doctors are more conscious of this is an image that it's actually not reflecting a good, healthy person. So, I must say sometimes I love to go and eat unhealthy food, and I have to do it in secret because just the thought of being found out by a patient, it's quite scary. And it happened quite a few times in a hawker store when I wasn't eating too healthy food, and that was a scary moment.
I have a slightly controversial question to ask.
All right.
Do some doctors seek out VIP patients for the limelight?
I'm not sure, actually.
I ask not because of any judgment on Malaysian doctors. Well, I don't know any Malaysian doctors who I would even imagine would do this. But in the cases of, say, just to pluck one out of the air, Michael Jackson.
Right.
For example, he famously was very poorly treated by his doctor at the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, he died essentially because a treatment that should never have been administered at home was administered at home. And we see that also with a lot of famous people who have dependencies or famous people who have...
I think doctors may... Certain doctors may like to treat VIPs because... Not because they like the limelight, because you can't share the limelight. Because whenever patient confidentiality comes into it, the doctors who treated Michael Jackson can't really tell the world that he was treating Michael Jackson until
Michael Jackson died,
right? Okay. And then so you don't do that to seek limelight, but you do that because you like the buzz of treating someone famous. Presumably, whenever you treat someone famous, you are, surrounded by people even more famous or people of the same caliber. And that sort of thing give you some buzz.
But, based on what you said earlier, I would now be worried if I were a VIP and, and I had an entourage and I'm the prime minister of some country somewhere, I would be worried about placing pressure on my doctor based on what you've said, because, there's that fear of messing up, and so I worry that my doctor might go too conservative, for example, because you just don't want to cut me open.
Yes.
Because you don't want to be the person who killed me on the table.
Messed up. Well, if you ask quite a few of my close colleagues, you would know that sometimes I try my best to avoid being in that situation. because recently I had somebody who presented with kidney stone, something that I do every single day, and then someone of extreme high VIP caliber, and then I decided that I opted out of that. I think partly for a reason that if I already have some degree of anxiety, I think I can't offer my best treatment for this person. So for that basis, I actually opted not to do that. And also, at the end of the day, you're probably just trying to avoid complications. It's like you want an easier life.
Is it hard handling the privacy of a VIP? I mean, on that note about wanting to avoid complications, I'm sure that one of the things that will happen is, people just
especially for my specialty.
Yes.
You imagine as a VIP, you are, Taylor Swift or somebody who actually walked in with a boyfriend to Dr. George Lee's clinic. The press will go crazy.
Who has the STD? Which one of you?
That's right. And then, I think in my specialty, particularly bad, because someone walked into my clinic and then, a room full of people waiting, and then suddenly a VIP of certain caliber. The first judgment is, why is he or she here?
So do you think then it's actually better for a VIP to pull the VIP card in order to get the privacy they need, because it would reduce anxiety on both your parts?
Absolutely. Well, I had people who actually requested to, make an entrance to my clinic via the back door. Unfortunately, my clinic is on the second floor with no back door. So, that was very stressful. And then in order to accommodate that, understanding that it is not for your
self-aggrandizement.
Okay. And then, it's purely for privacy purposes. And then we actually asked for certain time, in the afternoon it's quieter. I actually did not accept any patient and free up 15 to 20 minutes of that so that the patient can actually get into the clinic without a room full of people. We have done that before. And so, and then we also ensure that when the patient was exiting, and then there were nobody in the clinic waiting. And I think that's fair, for sensitive subjects like my job, and it might be for simple things like kidney stones.
Right? But they don't want people's tongues flying.
That's right. Yeah. And then suddenly, in social media, people are talking about, so-and-so went to see Dr. George Lee. Surely it's because of XYZ. Yeah.
Hi there. VIP treatment, of course it happens. Don't kid ourselves. I've seen it with my own eyes in government hospitals, especially in government hospitals. But what can we do as mere ordinary people? We can't afford private healthcare.
Well, of course, in most hospitals, they have all these kind of complaint mechanism and things like that. And then at the end of the day, there's always excuses, isn't it? Well, because one thing that can cut the queue is priority on the basis of medical reasons, right? And then sometimes people can argue that, and it's difficult to debate or to actually put your reasons forward, because, number one is a confidential information. Number two, people can always argue on a point of medical reasons. And unfortunately, we have a culture like that, because we have a culture of string pulling. And a lot of people want to do different things, and then they just say, who knows what, and then and that sort of thing. And until we get rid of that culture, I think this is something that VIP treatment is, because people get datorships so that they can get special seats and special treatments in government hospitals, government, departments, civil servants, and that sort of things. And I think, I find that sort of culture very engraved in a Malaysian society.
So one thing I was curious about is, we've spoken before about family, kind of coming into the consultation room with you. And sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, because it might prevent you from being able to speak clearly. It might, on the other hand, be good because you have support. When it comes to people who are VIPs who come in with an entourage,
yes,
how does that work? How does that affect you?
That is even more difficult. Let's say you have an entourage for security reasons. All these are bodyguards. And then it's like, suddenly you need to ask things like, your sexual habits and, your bowel habits and that sort of thing. And these are very personal things. And you would imagine that a lot of these will be censored or self-censored. And then you have to take that into account. And however, I think whenever the under my specialties, whenever you mention this to the entourage that you know, some of the things that we mentioned might be a bit private, perhaps you just give me 5 minutes or so, especially examinations, right? You know, when you need to do like a, you know, examination waist down, you definitely need that privacy. And then during that time is usually when I kind of ask the sensitive questions. But sometimes the VIP said, look, you know, my entourage is my confidant and knows everything about me. Please don't hesitate to ask any question. Then obviously, if the patient allows it, then there's no issue.
So the sense I'm getting from you, Dr. George, you know, here in my faux therapy setting, is that you don't seem very incredibly comfortable with the idea of treating VIPs. Would you shy away from treating, you know, leaders of our nation, like or world leaders for that matter? Would you kind of, despite the fact that it would be a buzz, or it would be?
You know, I would completely do that. It's like, you know, if Lee Hsien Loong in those years had come to George Lee and said, look, I've got prostate cancer, you know, and I hear that you're the person who can do my radical prostatectomy, I would just say, I'm sorry, but
would
I don't
you
think
really?
Seriously, because I would find somebody who would probably do radical prostatectomy repeatedly. I would definitely refer him on to somebody who's a lot better than me. And I guess, you know, it's not difficult to find that. And then and actually refer on. So I won't kind of refer him to somebody like, you know, my worst enemy, so that, you know, they, you know, this person will suffer or anything like that. For the best interest of the patient, number one, I find it extremely pressurized to do that. And then because of that, it might compromise on the care. And on that basis, I will pass on the case.
Wow.
You're surprised?
I'm kind of surprised.
Yeah, because I mean, you think that I will grab onto this?
Because I would think...
Is it a buzz?
No, just because I would think as a doctor, you would kind of want to provide care for somebody who is providing care for the nation. For example, it's not so much about fame, just more about...
Well, you're doing your part to serve the nation. Well, I think I'm doing my part to serve Joe Bloggs, and then I'm very happy with that. And I think in order to serve somebody for that extra buzz or extra mileage, that it is only for my self-ego. I think, you know, I will pass it on to some other people who are more comfortable doing that.
In conclusion then, VIP syndrome, a real thing or no?
Yes and no.
Well, you want to clarify?
To some people, yes. You know, for somebody who loved the buzz and then who loved that sort of like, you know, the drive and then to be in the, not necessarily in the limelight, but to have that buzz. And then for some people, you know, just doing your day-to-day job itself is rewarding enough. No.
Fall in the latter category.
Right. And you're surprised because, you know, for somebody who has been coming to this station for the last 8 years, you would think that I would hold all the kind of like VIPs and then
no,
try to do
it. No,
like
you think I'm being cruel, but that's not it. I just thought
just
that
purely
as somebody who has been a doctor for so many years, you know, you'd be comfortable with it. That's where I'm coming from. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I am comfortable if I actually don't know who they are. Seriously. And then sometimes only after treatment, I was told, do you know that person is so-and-so? And then so under emergency setting, I would just get on with it and then later on find out, that's all right.
Okay, you heard it here first. Dr. George Lee debunking VIP syndrome for the regular doctors everywhere. You have been listening today to Doctor in the House on Health and Living. And we've got some songs that will take you up to the news. After this, we've got the Rifles with Long Walk Back. You are listening today to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.